Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, we'll be continuing with our ongoing dialogue concerning important issues involving our environment, alternative medicine, natural ways of healing. All these are available today. And we're going to be taking calls. Our calls today will be from our WBAI audience in New York. That number, 212-209-2900. Again, 212-209-2900. And while you're thinking about the issues you'd like to address, and we will certainly do that, let me give you some of the latest in health and nutrition update information. And again, this is generally not, for most Americans, not common knowledge. I want to thank Scott Hudson for sending this over to me. This is from Amy Norton, Reuters. In findings that link at least some cases of Gulf War syndrome to chemical exposure during the war, Dallas researchers have found signs of brain damage in veterans who suffer recurring dizzy spells. These Gulf War veterans show electrical abnormalities in the brain stem that mirror these in victims of nerve gas attacks in the Tokyo subway in 1995. Dr. Robert Haley, one of the study authors, told Reuters that this is evidence of real brain damage, probably caused by multiple low-level chemical exposures. Haley and his colleagues at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center reported the findings in the March issue of the Journal of Archives of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery. In the study, Haley's team compared 23 veterans diagnosed with Gulf War syndrome with 10 healthy Gulf War veterans and 10 soldiers who were not deployed to the Gulf. They found that among those with Gulf War syndrome, they had 21 bouts of dizziness daily in most cases. In fact, only 5 of the other soldiers said they had ever had dizzy spells, and those were only intermittent. The Kern study arose from a larger one in which Dr. Haley and his colleagues defined 3 distinct types of Gulf War syndrome. Now, what's important is this. There is no question and no debate that the soldiers were exposed to such substances as DEET, D-E-E-T, which is a very powerful insecticide repellent. Also, medicines including PB, which is a form of bromine, which is very toxic. And these were given to soldiers sometimes as many as 3 times a day to supposedly protect them from any potential nerve gas attacks. We also know they were exposed to depleted uranium and experimental vaccines. Now, up to this point, the official position is there is no such thing as Gulf War syndrome. It's merely a post-traumatic stress syndrome. The VA, the Defense Department, the Pentagon, and the White House have all said there is no legitimacy to the 250,000 soldiers who are now suffering with their families the symptom. Now, here's what's of interest. At no time in presidential elections was this an issue. At no time in the war crimes tribunals was this an issue. In fact, I'm rather surprised when you consider some of the things that have gone on in Central American and South American countries, including Guatemala and Salvador, where we're interested in, rightly so, in bringing to international tribunals those who have engaged in systematic genocide. But what are those who've worked in systematic torture, systematic undermining of democratic principles, systematic repression of tens of thousands of individuals in these societies? Nothing, absolutely nothing, has been done to challenge, bring him to justice. With a rare exception like a Pinochet, no one else has even been considered. Well, if it is shown, as I believe in time that it will be, but not in time to save a lot of these vets, that the government knowingly used these vets as human guinea pigs, as historically they have, that is not the rantings of a complete paranoid, delusional fantasy. The fact is, the government is actually under its own, a very strict policy, been forced to acknowledge at least 1,900 separate experiments just with radiation alone, not including all the other things it's experimented with. So when you start looking at the evidence clearly and objectively, you start to see there's a pattern of behavior here. Because if the government were to acknowledge that these things were real and did cause these things, then the question is, would anyone know about it? Did they know they were toxic? And then that opens up a can of worms to which it would go to the highest levels, both the military and in the Defense Department and Pentagon and the White House. Anyhow, up to this point, unless there's irrefutable scientific evidence to the contrary, they're saying it's all in your head. Thus far, there are 61 separate scientific studies, just like this one that I'm just reporting on, from a peer-reviewed journal done at the University of Texas Southwestern, showing, yes, they are real physical conditions, and they should be dealt with. So no longer can those apologists for the military-industrial complex and the warped policies of those that created this boondoggle get away with it with complete impunity. I am updating and revising completely my documentary on AIDS and my white paper on AIDS, on Gulf War Syndrome, that will have all of the newest information, because when I first produced the special and the white paper, the studies were not in yet. So it was still those apologists saying, well, there's no hard concrete evidence. Same thing the tobacco industry did, alcohol industry, sugar industry, the meat industry, cyclamates, saccharins, NutraSweet, DDT, same identical form of argument. Well, prove to us that when someone was exposed to this, this happened. Now that evidence is there, probably more so and with greater detail with Gulf War Syndrome than any of the above I just mentioned. So, now it's time for political action, and I am updating my webpage to reflect all of the scientific evidence so that these things can be brought before legislative committees. I would like to see a special prosecutor, much like the Watergate special prosecutor, to bring back Schwarzkopf, to bring back some of the other individuals who were policymakers, put them under oath, and ask them questions. Questions that were not asked first time around, and or they let their answer slide. Because now we're dealing with a lot of human beings suffering and dying needlessly. I also have this. This came in today. This is from Seventh Generation. It's called Taking the Planet to the Cleaners, the Dry Cleaning Dilemma. I'll quote it verbatim. It's only a page and a half long. It says, for many people, one of the few constants in the modern world is the weekly dry cleaning bill. There's always some fine washable that can't be washed, some delicate something that requires the gentle treatment that only your dry cleaner can provide, least to shrink, wrap, or otherwise mutate into the world's most expensive rag. Unbeknownst to many, however, is the fact that dry cleaning is a hazardous process that uses toxic chemicals, poisons the environment, our clothing, and us. Dry cleaning got its start in France in the mid-19th century when people discovered that solvents like kerosene and turpentine cut through grease and other clothing stains that reacted poorly to soap and water. Today, we haven't come that far from this original process, though we now know that fancy machines and less flammable chemicals are available, the fundamentals are much the same. We're still just substituting chemicals for soap and water in order to clean our delicate garments. 80% of dry cleaners in America use a solvent called PERC, which is a solvent. They also employ benzene, formaldehyde, naphthalene, trichloroethylene, and xylene. These liquids are placed in a rotating cleaning drum along with your clothing that's been separated by color, fabric, and weight. After a specific amount of time, the drum spins out the majority of the solvent and hot air evaporates the remaining fluid before the garment is pressed and bagged. These solvents excel at removing soils and stains without damaging fabrics. Unfortunately, they also excel at making us sick. PERC has been linked to cancer, liver and nervous system damage, infertility, hormonal disruption, and a host of less serious conditions from nausea to dizziness. 57 million pounds of PERC are used each year by the country's 34,000 dry cleaners, and around 12 million pounds are released into the air. This widespread use has been made PERC one of the more ubiquitous chemicals in the environment. A persistent organic pollutant, it's been found in breast milk, cow's milk, meat, cooking oil, fruit, fish, shellfish, even algae. It's been identified in rainwater, seawater, groundwater, rivers, and lakes. It's everywhere, even on your clothes. Clothing washed in PERC or other solvents often comes home from the cleaners a little less than clean. Residues of these toxins can remain in the fibers of dry cleaning garments, especially when clothes are placed in a plastic bag soon after processing is completed. In fact, the EPA studies have found that fumes from dry clean clothing are a common source of indoor air pollution. For this reason, it's recommended that you remove the plastic bag and air it out for several days in a safe, isolated, and well-ventilated location to let these residues evaporate. Of course, it's better and safer not to dry clean at all. In fact, many dry cleaning-only labels have been placed on garments by overly cautious manufacturers whose products needn't necessarily be dry cleaned at all. Hand washing and air drying, or gentle cold water machine washing in low dry heat, or air dry cycles can often do the job if gentle soaps are used. Now, that's important. And there are a lot of books on this that shows you which ones to buy, like Better Basics at Home by Annie Bertha Bond, or Home Safe Home by Deborah Lynn Dadd, who have good information. And there are also non-toxic professional dry cleaning alternatives emerging. Three technologies have found a way to clean delicate clothes safely and without solvents like PERC. One uses a bath of liquid carbon dioxide and special detergents to clean clothes. Another uses safer silicone-based solvents instead of petroleum-based solvents like PERC. And the third most established technology is called wet cleaning. It uses old-fashioned water, special detergents, and computer-operated machines to carefully control the process. So, those are good options to us. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's go to the phones. Please do not call in on a cell phone. Do not use a cordless phone in your home. Try to use your main phone and turn off the radio when you do call. Otherwise, we'll get an echo and a feedback. The other day, someone left one of the lines open, and for a half hour on Rory of Hollywood, we had an echo, in which made the show unusable for the other stations. So please turn your radio off, and we'll take your calls. What's your name, please? You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My name is Barbara, and thank you for taking my call. I've been home for about a week. I had emergency surgery for twisted intestines, and I'd just like you to give as much information as you can on what happens to the body when you have a twisted intestines, and also the best way to go about rebuilding.
What did the surgery accomplish?
They removed a foot and a half of gangrenous intestines. It was successfully reattached, and I don't have a colostomy or anything.
What were you eating and drinking for the last several years up to your surgery?
I've been through a couple of your support groups. I'm strict vegetarian. I'm following your protocol. I've been no sweets, no sugar, no dairy, no flour, no whole wheat. I do. My diet is good. It has
good.
Been since almost 2 years now.
Good. Okay, that's a very positive step. You understand that this was probably something you've had there your whole life.
Yeah, because I had surgery about 15 years ago, abdominal surgery, and I was told that adhesions had grown and twisted around the intestines, and that was the reason for the obstruction, which had been slowly poisoning my body mm-hmm. over the years. I've been diagnosed with all different types of diseases, and probably based on what they've explained to me, I didn't have those things, but the twisting of the intestines, the poisoning of my body caused me to seem to have a lot of joint problems.
No, you look at it from a little different perspective for a moment. Let me just take you on a step-by-step to explain what actually was happening, all right?
Okay.
The intestines are almost in loops, almost like a cowboy's lasso. It goes in loops around. You have your ascending, your descending, your transverse, colon, rectum. These are all part of this dynamic part of the body. Now, they're not stationary. They're nerve endings and muscle fibers that allow this this almost an embryonic sac, but it's a very, very hard sac with a smooth mucous membrane material, similar to what's your lips. Your lips are different than your skin because your lips actually begin your furthest extension from your anus of your digestive apparatus. That's why you have certain stimuli and certain nerve cells in your lips that you don't have on your cheeks. And the color is different. The capacity for rejuvenation. If you burn your tongue, you'll notice that it hurt. But within a day, it's almost healed. The same burn on your skin might take a week to heal. You turn over a lot of cells, dead cells, at the rate of almost 1% per day will occur in the intestine. Nature is so wonderful in its understanding of our needs that it allowed the cells of the intestine and the cells of the skin to replace themselves at a very rapid rate. The skin that you see is actually dead tissue. That's epidermal tissue. What's underneath of it, the dermis, and then the subcutaneous tissue is where the life is. The skin on the intestines has to tolerate two extremes, alkaline and acid. And if you have a hyperacidic acid, like in your stomach, if you've been eating a lot of meat or drinking alcohol or a lot of sugar, that creates a hyperacidic reaction. Certain medicines will also do the same thing. That means that every time you go to digest food and food goes from the bottom part of the stomach, and look at an upside-down pear. That's pretty much what the stomach looks like in its anatomy. And there's two holes in that, two little flaps. And depending upon your size, those flaps can be small, like a quarter, or larger. The one at the top, where food actually first enters the stomach, is called the cardiac sphincter. That opens. And it doesn't just arbitrarily open. It opens based upon food coming into it. And then it closes. If it didn't close, then you would have gastric acids, what's called a gastric reflux, going up into the system. And that causes what we know as heartburn. It really has nothing to do with the heart. It's just that that part of the esophagus that drops down to meet the top part of the stomach, that's where that acid, hydrochloric acid, gets burped back up, or a hiatal hernia will force some of it back up, or eating too much food or having too much liquid in a meal, overfilling the stomach, which can expand to about almost a quart. But for normal digestion, it should be small amounts. If you want a better digestion, always have smaller amounts of food. Quite simply, the more food's in your stomach, the longer digestion occurs, because the stomach has to, in effect, do what a food processor would do. It has to, through a process called hydrolysis, break all that partially chewed food, whether it's brown rice or a hamburger, and it's really got a tough time with fats. Fats are the most difficult things to digest. The fats in nuts are particularly difficult. It has to digest it all. And there are enzymes like lipase and protease that will help amylase, lactase, that break down. These are enzyme stimulators that stimulate a process that, where they don't get up used up in themselves, they cause something to happen. So now you eat, food goes in the stomach. The stomach starts the process of breaking all this down into what is called chyme. And this chyme has to be almost the consistency of a thick pudding. And if it is, then you've got good digestion, because you're going to have good assimilation and good elimination. food should go into the top part of the intestines, where the and that's where that another little sphincter opens up, and the pyloric sphincter opens up. In goes the food in the intestine, in the top 12 inch of the intestine, called the duodenum or duodenum. It deacidifies it. It has to, because the rest of that colon and intestines is alkaline. And whatever was not properly digested in the way of carbohydrates or fats has one more go, not proteins. Proteins have had it in the stomach. If you eat and have a cola, bad combination. Really bad. Why? Because the cola has hydrochloric acid and sugar. That sugar, in the presence of acid, creates a hyperacidic reaction, which is one of the reasons a lot of people burp a lot after drinking colas. Not just the fact that it's carbonated and releases, in effect, releasing gas bubbles. Then you have protein. Now, if you ever watched anyone eat a hamburger, they'll take generally 1.5 bites. That's it. 1.5 chews and swallow it. Every third chew is followed by a drink. What happens is that the stomach then does not have an opportunity to digest food with its own medium. It is being forced to adapt to a highly liquefied, highly, highly acidic medium. And that causes a hyper digestion and a dumping sensation. The dumping sensation is, depending upon how much someone eats, if they eat a lot of food and then get busy again, as young people tend to do. Older people eat a lot of food and then they take it easy because their body starts to bring energy into the digestive system. When you bring that energy into the digestive system, you have to take it away from the cells. In effect, the body has to be told, slow down, you're going too fast, you've got food in your system, we have to digest it, because this food is going to be the energy that you need to continue healing, cleansing, building enzymes, building the building blocks of protein, and so slow it down. Now, one of the things that we can do, we can slow down, but go for a brisk walk. A brisk walk after eating a meal is an enormously beneficial way of helping digestion, because it's bringing blood and oxygenation so that the process is enhanced. The worst thing you can do is go and lay down after a big meal, because then the food sits there. And most people overeat. Most people eat more than what they should in any given sitting, because of this whole notion of eating everything on your plate and if you're hungry or not. Well, we should do what the Europeans do and just serve less on a plate. But we tend to have the smorgasbord mindset to everything in life, and the more the better. So we want to just pack it in until we're absolutely full. Bad choice. Never eat till you're full. Again, it is very unhealthy to stuff yourself. You should always leave a meal still feeling somewhat hungry, that you could still have more food in you. If you do that, A, you're going to lose weight, B, have more energy, C, have better digestion, D, have better assimilation of the nutrients from what you've eaten, and E, have less taxing reactions to your intestine and your stomach. So that takes you, at least to get you to understand what's happening when you eat. So you should drink before a meal or drink after a meal, but not during a meal, unless what you're drinking is itself part of the meal, and in which case it is actually a part of the food. Now, once that food goes in the intestine, it starts its journey. Now, if it's healthy food and it's not overconsumed, then what is called peristalsis. It's a wave-like rhythmic movement, almost like watching a snake. A snake slither on the ground, that's what your intestines look like. And they have to move, because you physically have to move the mass through the intestine. Now, because we have food at different stages of digestion, we are always holding anywhere from 1 to 13 to 15 pounds of partially or indigested food in our intestine at any given time. The largest cleansing movement occurs while we're sleeping. because that's when the body's going through a catabolic movement and wants to get this debris that's no longer of value to the body out of the body. It also has to take the water that has been crucial for the digestive process to exist. It wants to reabsorb it so you don't dehydrate. And that's why you don't have diarrhea when you eat. When you wake up in the morning, you have more of a solid, formed mass of debris made up of dead cells from the body, and also undigested oligocellulose, the undigestible fibers. And most fibers are undigestible. Anything that's insoluble cannot be digested. If it's soluble, it can. So then you have all this happening. And the other is bacteria. Here's what's interesting. You have more bacteria in your body than you have cells, which makes it rather remarkable. And that we're just that loaded with bacteria. Now, that's not bad if the bacteria is good bacteria. And what determines whether or not you have good bacteria in the intestines is the quality of what you've put into the intestines. Now, meat is a dead tissue. It is morbid. Quite simply, think of it this way. Would you ever go into a morgue, go and throw a sheet off a leg, cut off the leg, shave the hair, broil it and eat it? Would you?
No.
Why not?
I'm sorry, I'm not even hearing. Can you repeat that?
Yeah, I'm just asking a basic question. What would be the difference of eating a leg of human or a leg of lamb?
I don't know if there is a difference.
Well, in the anatomy, there's nothing different. Now, you wouldn't want to eat a leg of human, but a lot of people have no problem eating a leg of lamb or a leg of steer or flank steak. And that flank is part of the comes up to the hindquarters. You'd never think about eating, you know, saying, ooh, I like the, let's go to a gourmet butt store. That's what we want. We have our choice. Which would be the best butt in the window to take home and broil, bake, deep fry? Cajun delight. We can even do a little breadcrumbs on it. You have white Anglo-Saxon male successful, white Anglo-Saxon male poor. African-American male, successful or poor. Jewish male, educated, not educated. You see all the different varieties you could have?
Mm-hmm.
A gourmet butt store. Then you could have a gourmet breast store, nail store. Well, you look at that and you think, well, why not? What's the difference of that? And then going into a meat market saying, I like, give me some tongue, and I want to eat a cow's tongue. Now, could you imagine going over into a pasture, asking a cow to open his mouth, looking inside, cutting his tongue off and eating on it? Would you think about doing that?
No, and just the thought of it is grossing me out.
But people eat cow's tongue.
I know that they do.
When you eat a hot dog, you're eating cow's tongue. When they say 100% beef, even kosher beef, you can have all kinds of parts of the animal. When it says it's all beef, that means testicles. Mm-hmm. That means a penis. Now, here's a question. What is a man that eats a penis?
I guess he's a meat eater, a penis eater.
Do you realize how many penis eaters we've got in America?
Yes, I do.
All those bar parks are filled with penis eaters. In fact, they ought to have a big sign, the penis eater section. We're eating penises today. Cow penises. Now, when you think about it, you think, well, that's not possible. Oh, yes, it is possible because they're putting it in there. Do you think they throw it away? You think someone on a butcher's line? I've watched them. I've been there. I filmed this. In fact, I have a documentary on this called The Unkindest Cut coming up. And they don't waste anything. Testicles. Of course they use the testicles. So now you've got testicles and penises. Now, would you look at a menu and say, I'd like some moderate size or large size? Now, there's where size may or may not count. Do you think most people would want a large, medium, or small, black, white, or brown penis and testicles?
Probably large.
Okay, so now they're going to have a ballpark, and of course, whoever's got the foot-long hot dog wins. And we actually have a lot of these people who want the big steak. But they're actually eating something that was alive. Now, the same use of a penis on a cow or a goat, and the same in a human. If you looked at one under a slide, if I took a section of a bull's penis, and by the way, that's what they give your dogs, those little, that's one of the most popular items. They crisp them up, and that's what dogs eat. Most people don't know that. That's one of those popular items people buy in the stores. Anyhow, look at that under slide, and you can't tell one from the other. It's merely the perception that allows us to do these things. And hence, our reality is based upon our perception. Perception creates our reality. And then the perception of what is real is accepted in without challenges being real. So we think, well, real men eat meat. No, all right. Real men eat hot dogs, hamburgers. Are you aware that your hamburger could have meat from 1,000 different cows?
Yes,
any part
I am.
Of the cow?
Mm-hmm.
As long as it says all meat? Well, think about the items that don't say 100% meat. Then they can have all other parts of the animal. Hoofs, ears, snouts of pigs. Now, just imagine, a pig is a rooter. A pig travels around the ground with its nose pushing up the soil. It did that because that's one of the ways it survived. It found roots and gourds underneath the ground, and it would dig down to them and eat them. And it's a dirty snout. Pig's not a dumb animal. Pigs are smart. Pigs are smarter than dogs. In fact, I've had probably about 100 pigs I've owned, and they live pretty long lives. They're very conscientious, very clean, if you allow them the environment to be clean. I had a pig that would go swimming, go out in the track and jog, housebroken. Wonderful, loving creature, very protective of the other animals. And my neighbor just looked at it as a meal. Everything was a meal. In fact, he would come over, this down in Texas, and he'd say, "Man, with as many people hungry, you know, and unemployed, you got to think about giving them some of these." I said, "Well, if they're that hungry and that unemployed, let them eat themselves." "Could eat my animals." "Yeah, go eat your neighbor. That's what you ought to do. Have a barbecue. Bob's not working. We'll barbecue Bob." "But don't touch my pig, I'll tell you that. Or my cats or dogs or any of my other animals." You never saw the fun in that. He was very serious. But he would. He'd hit an animal, and you'd see the animal out there, and then one day you wouldn't see the animal. "Oh, we ate it." I just could never see that whole concept. Anyhow, the idea is that tissue, once you've killed it, the defense mechanism that allowed it to maintain its own health, which is substantial. In fact, a dog's immune system, a cat's immune system, a cow's immune system, and an elephant's immune system is far, far, far more powerful than yours or mine. For a simple reason, it is consuming massive amounts of toxins nonstop. Everything that eats grasses is also pulling up the soil, which contains the micronutrients and pathogens. If you were to go out right now and put some dirt in your mouth from a field that had never been walked on, there would still be pathogenic bacteria in that soil that could hurt you, that could kill you, even organic produce. And yet, your dog will eat a bone, bury a bone, eat a bone. That some dogs will eat anything, dead, live, it doesn't matter. They don't die. Cats the same way. How's that possible? How's it possible that in Africa, all these animals go to the same watering hole where, and you know, it's not a matter of hygiene there. It's absolutely septic. It's absolutely toxic. And yet, their whole lives will go to the same watering hole, and they'll drink from it every day. And in the drought season, you know, constantly. How is it that an alligator can live in a septic environment for 150 years. 100 years easily. That's because their immune systems. We don't have that immune system. Now imagine this. Their immune systems protect them from the very bacteria, parasites, viruses, and microbes that they would quickly die from if they didn't have it. Now, the moment you kill any animal, the moment it dies, all of those positive protective mechanisms that kept it safe and healthy stop. Everything that would have caused the animal to get sick and die become dominant. There's nothing to hold them in check. They run rampant. And they actually start a process of, in effect, degrading the very flesh. And so when you buy a piece of meat, any meat, or chicken, you're buying a diseased piece of flesh. And that's going into that intestine. Now, anywhere from 40 to 60% of your entire immune system is located in your gastrointestinal system for a simple reason. Everything that goes in that intestine that becomes toxic has to be fought against so it doesn't get into the main bloodstream and kill the whole body. So your body's got enormous defenses constantly around you. Now, if you eat healthy food and probiotic food and you don't have the sugars and the meats and contaminants and pollutants, then your immune system is able to free itself up to go to other parts of your body to help protect you from other localized infections. It can go up to your sinuses. It can go into your throat. And therefore, you can go through a season without getting a cold or flu, even though you're around other people who are sick and you have been exposed, but your body's other mucous membranes are able to fight against the contamination. That's how it works. Are you following up to this point?
Yes, I am.
So the more toxins you bring into your system, the more of your defense mechanisms must go away from other parts of the body to the intestines. Hence the idea of cleaning the intestines. The health of the intestines becomes the crucial first stage of keeping you well. But we've never focused on that in our society, at least not in the last 50 years. And almost everything that we eat is unhealthy. And almost everything we eat actually contributes to disease and has no life force energy. That's a separate issue, but that's a very important part of it. So now we have protein, we have carbohydrates, we have fats, but we don't have vital life energy, we don't have quality enzymes, we don't have quality fiber. That creates what is called autotoxemia, where the intestine begins, instead of having food and even improper digestion and improper food combining, it tends to make the intestines clog up. As the intestines clog up, it's like sticking mud into a pipe. It just doesn't go through. Versus putting a soup into a pipe and it flows through. That means it's more difficult to absorb the nutrients because of this impactation. It also means that there are cancer-causing agents. And it's a culture where the good bacteria die off, the bad bacteria take their place, and now you've got a toxic stew in your intestines. That's the average American. They're very toxic. Now, when you're that toxic, the body is still going to reabsorb the water from that toxic mess. But it has to filter it. And the only way it can filter it is through its immune system, because there's no other special filtration system within the tissues. So what is happening is that many, many more times what would be normal of the immune system is used up on trying to detoxify the water being absorbed back into the system from this toxic mess so that your body has the proper hydration level. Now, imagine that you went to the bathroom in the morning in a toilet bowl and would you stick a cup in there and drink from the water that wasn't touching whatever you put in that toilet bowl?
No, I would not.
Why not?
Because I would consider it to be not good hygiene.
Not good hygiene,
and
all right.
What's coming out of my body is, I don't think is fit for human consumption.
Okay, you're right. Here's a question for you. What's the difference of drinking out of a toilet bowl you've just defecated in than versus the body having absorbed water from a toxic intestine where that same defecation is in it?
I don't think there's any difference.
There is no. What's in your intestine? What's in your colon?
Everything that I've eaten.
Everything is going in the toilet bowl, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the water that's in there is being absorbed back.
Right.
So is there any difference then between a toilet bowl with water and your intestine with water and toxin?
No, there isn't.
No difference. And that's the whole point I'm trying to make. Graphic, yes. Gross, yes. Disgusting. Depends upon your perspective. If you learn from it, so you'll wake up and realize, hey, I wasn't aware that I'm that toxic. You are. That gross. You are. That does that capacity to in effect disable my immune system. You have, not you personally, but I'm talking about those people who just think very cavalierly, oh, dole doesn't matter, it's all nonsense. Well, you can justify and rationalize anything on an intellectual level. Doesn't mean that it changes the reality of what's happening in your body. So that's what happens to other parts of the body. So when you were told that you had these other illnesses like inflammation and pains in your joint, you did. In part because your intestine, because of a physiological abnormality where you had a twist in the intestine so the food could not pass through in a normal fashion. And from years before you started a health program, you had a lifetime of putting the same toxins in that twisted intestine, causing them to build up. So in effect, when you were younger and stronger, your immune system was fighting 24 hours a day to detoxify what was occurring in what we call pressure-related illnesses in the intestine, diverticulitis, spastic colon, colitis, etc. But then one day, there was simply not enough defenders to stave off the attacks. It was like the Alamo. Too many, 5,000 the enemy coming through the breaches, and only 60 guys left, and they just went into the middle, put up their last stand, boom, gone. Same way in your intestine. Your intestine can't fight it off. The bacteria gets in the system, causes local inflammation, goes to your joints, and there it causes inflammatory condition. It can go to your heart, your brain, encephalitis in the brain, and nervous system, carditis in the heart. You could have it go into the lymphatic system and end up with a lymphedema. You could have it go into the pancreas and have pancreatitis. So where these local inflammatory processes occur is really secondary to the issue of how they occur. So how something happens is the first question. Why it happens and what we can do about it becomes the second question. Are you following me up to this point?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So the reason you had these other conditions, that was merely secondary to what was occurring in your intestine, not primary or separate. But medicine wouldn't understand that. They're clueless on this. They're going to say, well, if you have 80 conditions, each one separate and distinct. No, they could all be connected. All because your body did not have enough of immune modulation to protect itself against what was going on in the intestine where all your defense mechanisms were, and didn't have enough to protect you at the other cells from the common effects of just living in a toxic world. Even conscious living in a toxic world, we still have to have a strong immune system to be diligent and surveying the internal body, or we get sick. So now you have to see that that intestine is kept clean. You can't cheat at all. You also don't want additional adhesions because that's going to create scar tissue. That'll create pain. It'll also create a never shortening space. So you want to use magnets. You want to put a magnetic pad across the abdomen between right above the navel to down to the pelvic area. That'll also help you with uterine fibroids in men, the prostate. It will help to pulse a magnetic pulse to repolarize the cell. That'll allow the intestines to do the work better. It'll help reabsorb scar tissue. It's one of the best things in the world for scar tissue. And you want to focus upon the nutrients that help turn off of inflammatory processes. Chlorophyll-rich juices are the best way of detoxifying the intestine. Green juices are the ultimate detoxifier. Followed by grapefruit juices and watermelon juices. There are herbs that are known for anti-inflammatory processes in the intestine and the rest of the body. That taken on a daily basis are there to superguard your immune system. Powdiarco, echinacea, bifidus bacteria, which you can buy in liquid form, 2 to 3 billion in a teaspoon once a day. And you get them from sauerkraut, which is very good for you, by the way. Sauerkraut's one of the best single foods you can eat, actually. Cayenne pepper, which is extremely healing. Vitamin C, quercetin, vitamin A, zinc, L-cysteine. Those are in reduced glutathione with bromelain. Those are the things that you should be on daily, and your juices are what really will be the high point of keeping that intestine flowing and keeping the debris moving, the bacteria in check. So that's how I would look at it. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much. Are the things that you've just listed that I should take? Since I just had the surgery about 2 weeks ago, is it too soon to start those? Should I wait for a period of time before I start that protocol? Because prior to having this emergency surgery, I was doing all of the things on your protocol for about the last 2 years. And so I was doing the green juices, the red juices, and everything. There was no cheating at all, which is probably why I fared as well as I did. During this whole process that was happening to me.
I would wait. What I would do is I would start doing them gradually, mm-hmm. and do it in, let's say, 1/5 increments. Mm-hmm. So take 1/5 amounts and build yourself up and do one at a time and see how you feel, and then the next week do another one. It's a gradual process. Keep this in mind. It's very good, and the reason that you're probably as healthy as you are today is because you had made these changes.
Right.
But had I known that you had this, I would have done a different protocol. It's like someone who comes see me and says, Gary, I have hepatitis C. All right. There's a very specific protocol for hepatitis C, but it's not going to be changed with the best diet and the best supplements.
Mm-hmm.
That will not make a whole lot of difference. There you have to have a specific holistic medical protocol.
Mm-hmm.
There's two different approaches. That which maintains good health, and that which helps us overcome from disease. If someone has cancer or AIDS or heart disease, it's not just a diet that is going to be looked at. And that's why it's helpful if we do have the proper diagnosis as we go along in life, and just to make sure that we're in optimal health. That's why I encourage people to do viral load tests and hormone-regulated tests after the age of 40 and a SMAC 24, so at least you get some idea of where you're at.
Mm-hmm.
Even a low energy could be indicative of some illnesses. So good diet, juices, and supplements all combined represent 25% on a scale of 1 to 100. And if you had a real challenge disease, which you did, but it was a mechanically related one that would mechanical obstruction that led to, then that means you had an enormous amount of debris in you, causing a severe inflammatory process.
Mm-hmm.
And that would normally take anywhere from 2 to 4 years to get ahead of that. And a holistic medical protocol enhances that speed at which that occurs.
Mm-hmm.
Follow me there?
Yes, I do.
Okay, well, good luck to you.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Bye.
Bye.
I'm Gary Noll. Your turn. You're on the air. What's your name, please? Hi.
Hi. My name is Sabina, and I have actually just probably a quick question that ties sort of in with the previous caller's question. I have been getting into cleaning my colon and doing juices and stuff. And my boyfriend picked up a poster about food combining, and that's very confusing because I'm really nervous. he picked up this poster about food combining, and it says, I have your juicing book, and, you know, it's the poster basically says, oh, you can combine this food with that food and fruits and vegetables and...
Okay, let me give you the short answer on this, all right?
Mm-hmm.
I wrote the book on food combining, and it was the only book I've ever written that I later regretted having written it, and because I was going upon my belief, and now I don't do that. I go upon on what is the science.
Mm-hmm.
I had accepted from a conversation I had had with Herbert Shelton, who was the leading natural hygienist of his era. And he had been talking to me for some time and was interested in doing a book with me. And at that time, I had the most popular selling health book in America. In fact, it was the first crossover bestseller, and Adele Davis was coming right on the heels of that with her books, and she had very popular selling books also. I was a young guy. I mean, I'm a real young guy. And I trusted everything that all these people said. You know, Paul Bragg and Joe Bonomo and Bob Hoffman and Carlton Fredericks and Lior Cardell and Pablo Irola. I thought, gee, these people must have a lot to share and a lot of good information. Well, he was down in San Antonio, Texas at the time. You know, I had a series of conversations with him. And I was so inspired by what he was sharing with me and talking about that I decided to do a book on food combining. And for my research, I used information that was generally available within the health field. After I wrote the book, and it was very successful, and it wasn't that there was anything that was wrong with it. I mean, if you follow the information, you're certainly going to be healthy. But I was out on tour, and one of my stops took me down to San Antonio. And I decided to see in for myself. I thought it'd be a nice surprise. It was not a surprise that I wanted. It was a horror show. I saw people who were dying because they were so rigidly adhering to this principle of fast until the disease is eaten up. My goodness, you know, people were grossly undernourished. They weren't taking vitamins. They weren't allowed to. And indeed, some people did die. And indeed, he was found guilty of this. And, oh yeah, you can get some people better by doing some controlled fasting, but you're going to get most people, the vast majority, sicker. And then when I took a careful look at the other materials, all this supposed research he had, he didn't have it. Then I felt like a fool because I had trusted someone I believed in, and that was one of many reality checks I would be getting. So then I went into the laboratory, and I decided to do actual studies. And I was the only one that I knew of, at least that time in the United States, was actually doing nutrition studies in laboratories using a holistic model. No one else had either a scientific background, degrees in this, any background research in clinical research at all. In fact, at that time, there were not even any board-certified nutritionists in the United States. You know, Fredericks had a PhD, but it was in public relations from New York University. So I did a series of studies with Dr. Berman. And every single study found the same thing. Every single one. Complex carbohydrates, seaweeds, salads, all could be eaten, grains and beans, all could be eaten at the same time. There was no interference, no difference in the nutritional, digestion, absorptive, or elimination outcome from that. Therefore, all these charts with acid and subacid were incorrect. and made it torturous for all but the most disciplined people to follow, and made it very difficult for most people to eat. It wouldn't be unhealthy for them to do that. It wasn't anything adverse in it. It just wasn't. It wasn't the reality. So I went back and I went to my publisher and I did something I'd never done. I had no money, but I said, I want to buy all this books. And so they kept my royalties, and they took all the books out of print, and I had to give them two more books because of that. That was a deal they loved. Here I'm giving them two books for free, took back the book, kept my royalties, and my one publisher never paid me a royalty. In fact, I'm probably the only author I know of that had one of the biggest selling books of all time and never received one single penny. I was one of the most exploited authors in America. I was a workhorse. And I'd knock out one bestseller after another bestseller and never saw a nickel. Couldn't even pay my rent, which was $67 a month. I'd be on television, Johnny Carson, all over the place, taking Greyhound buses to these things. Had one suit of clothes I'd gotten. It's the Empire Clothing for $29.95. But I decided I wouldn't allow a book that didn't represent what I considered, what I was able to prove out in the market. And that's why I'm always revising and updating, revising and updating. If you find out something new, drop the old and go with what is newer and more important in reality. If you've disproven yourself in the past, then correct it. So virtually everything we've learned about Fuku mining has to be seen in light of where all that information originated and what's real. Now, here is what is real about Fuku mining. This part is real. Sugar eaten with anything will interfere in the digestion of whatever is eaten unless it's another sugar. That is a reality. Fat, as processed fats, lard, butter, fat in meat, will slow down digestion. Hence, if you have a steak and then you have a dessert with it, you've improperly combined your foods and you end up with indigestion. So therefore, the indigestion that we see that has become a billion-dollar market for antacids is because of people's eating the wrong way. And but that is not true for people who are combining foods like the grains, nuts, beans, seeds together. You follow me? Okay, thanks for your call. We're out of time. I want to thank you all very much for listening, and I'll look forward to sharing more with you on tomorrow's program. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day, everyone.